I wonder if you've ever received an email, you get emails like this, from a friend or family member, and it started like this. This is one that I received from a guy called Tim St. John. He was a friend of mine at Bible college. And he said, "How are you doing today? I am sorry I didn't inform you about my traveling to Africa for a program called Empowering Young Adults to Fight Racism, HIV, AIDS and Poverty. The program is taking place in three major countries in Africa, which are Ghana, South Africa and Nigeria. I'm really stranded in Nigeria because I forgot my little bag with my money, passport, documents and other valuable things that are kept in the taxi on my way to the hotel where I am lodged. I am facing a hard time here because I have no money on me. I am now owing a hotel bill of $900 and they want me to pay the bill or else they will have to seize my other bag and hand me over to the hotel management. I need this $900 to be fed and help myself back home. So please can you help me with a sum of $1,800 to sort out my problems here? I need this help so much on time because I am in a terrible and tight situation." Now, before I finish this email, this is a very smart guy. And then he said this, "I'm sending you this email from the hotel's cafe, and I only have 10 min to do so. I will appreciate whatsoever you can afford to send me for now, and I promise to pay you back money as soon as I return home. So please let me know on time so that I can forward you the details you need to transfer the money through MoneyGram or Western Union." Now, that was a complete fake. It was an absolute complete fraud. Tim St. John was a very clever guy, very good at English, very good at the biblical languages that he studied at seminary. And it only took me a little while to read this email that I was about three or four lines down where I actually discovered this was a complete fraud. And for the first couple of lines, you're going, "Yeah, why did Tim St. John go to Africa? I didn't know he was away going to this place over the summer holidays." But the more I put the microscope, so to speak, over this email, after reading just a couple of lines, I could tell it was a fake. And in this story that we have this morning, Jesus is putting the microscope onto the people of Israel. Jesus is marching his way to his death on Good Friday. This is now the Tuesday or Wednesday, depending on how you interpret the last events of Jesus' life in this week in Jerusalem. And now he's going to put his microscope right on to the very temple precincts and to the very heart of worship in the Jewish people. And when he applies his microscope, he wants to find out, are they true worshippers or are they fake worshippers? And as we sit underneath the authority of this text this morning, Jesus, I believe, is doing the same thing with you and I. Because the Bible says in 2 Corinthians 3 that the temple of God is now within you. And we'll find that out as we go through this text. And so while Jesus in this story over 2,000 years ago puts his microscope onto the temple precincts, into the Holy of Holies and the whole sacrificial system to see if the people of Israel really are true worshippers, he also puts his microscope on your heart this morning. Are you a fake or a fraud? Do you present yourself as certain type of Christian this morning or tonight or Wednesday night at the prayer meeting or in your home groups? But the person that you are through the rest of the week is a completely different person. And as Jesus is marching his way to the cross in just a couple of days' time, he is looking for worshippers who will worship him in spirit and truth. He doesn't want fakes or frauds. He wants people who will worship him from the very depths of their heart. Last week we found out that he wants to be Lord. Last week we discovered that there are certain things in our lives that we want to make Jesus Lord, King, Master, Controller over, like when we need a job or when we need a situation sorted. But there are other things in our lives that we don't want Jesus to be Lord over. We're quite happy to be the king in these certain areas of our lives. But Jesus said, no, I want to be Lord and master over everything. And so Jesus is coming into this temple precinct and he comes to the temple of our hearts this morning. And I think there's a theme emerging, an overarching theme if you're taking notes, and I believe it's this. Fruitless hearts produce fake worship. Fruitless hearts produce fake worship. And Jesus is going to come to a fig tree here and the temple here. And really the fig tree story and the temple story are the same thing. Jesus is teaching the disciples, and then when he comes into the temple, the scribes and the Pharisees, the same lesson, that fruitless hearts produce fake worship. But let's join Jesus in the text in chapter 11, verse 12. And the first point comes from verses 12 to 14. Jesus condemns hypocritical religion. Jesus condemns hypocritical religion. Look what it says in verse 12. The next day, as they were leaving Bethany, Jesus was hungry. And seeing in the distance a fig tree in leaf, he went to find out if it had any fruit. And when he reached it, he found nothing but leaves, because it was not the season for figs. Last week in chapter 11, verses 1 to 11, we saw the omniscience of Jesus. That he knows everything about these last days and hours of his life. He's planning every little detail. He knows what's going on in the heart of the Pharisees and the scribes and the teachers of the law. He knows that they don't want to arrest him during this Passover week. They want to kill him in the weeks that follow. But Jesus, the divine, omniscient, all-knowing master planner, is planning his death on the Friday. But in these two verses, we actually see the humanity of Jesus. Jesus was a human as well as being God. And it says he was hungry. But then Jesus, the master teacher, also takes this illustration of being hungry and going to a fig tree as an opportunity to teach his disciples again. When it comes to this fig tree, what he should have found was a tree with leaves on it, but some unripe figs on the tree. And so he's approaching this fig tree. You can see the leaves that are meant to be there, which is a sign of life and a sign that something should be growing there. But as he starts to get closer to the fig tree and he starts to put his microscope onto the fig tree, as he gets closer and closer, what he finds are some of the leaves which should be a sign of life, but he finds no figs. And so Jesus draws the disciples a little bit closer because he wants to teach them a lesson about what he's just about to do. Look what he said in verse 14. Then Jesus said to the tree, "May no one ever eat fruit from you again." And his disciples, this is important, his disciples heard him say it. Perhaps as Jesus said these words, he would have had in mind the words of prophecy in Jeremiah chapter 8, verse 13, where it says this, "I will take away their harvest, declares the Lord. There will be no grapes on the vine. There will be no figs on the tree. And their leaves will wither. What I have given them will be taken from them." And Jesus, just hours before he marches down the Mount of Olives and he marches up the mountain where the temple is and he moves into the court of the Gentiles and then there's the court of Israel and then there's the Holy of Holies. Jesus, the master teacher, is going to give his disciples this amazing illustration that the nation of Israel had become a completely hypocritical and spiritually bankrupt nation. They had signs of life externally. But as Jesus would say to his disciples and to the Pharisees and the scribes, internally they were full of dead man's bones. Their religion and their worship was in words only, but their hearts were far from Jesus. And as we come to church this morning, it's easy to throw rocks at the Pharisees and the scribes, but can't we do the same? We can worship God externally. We can sing great hymns of the faith. We can open up our Bibles, but are our hearts far from Jesus? Because Jesus here is condemning hypocritical religion.
at the heart of Jesus' mission to earth was the fact he was looking for worshippers who would worship him in spirit and truth. That our worship would come from a genuine heart. And so I believe Jesus comes knocking at our hearts this morning and he asks, are you a true worshipper? Or are you a hypocritical worshipper? Do you forward something on Sunday that is not the truth about you during the week? One writer has said, who you are before God, when you are alone, when no one is around, is who you are before God. And for the Pharisees and the scribes, maybe this has been a slow fade, and maybe in your own life it's been a slow fade where gradually you've been letting sins creep into your heart, which like a snowball rolling down a hill, the more it rolls and rolls and rolls, the bigger sins become, and how they start to entangle themselves around our hearts, and slowly our worship for God is replaced by serving other masters. And doesn't the Bible say no one can serve two masters? You will either love one or hate the other. And what we find here are the Pharisees and the scribes who love themselves, who love the prestige, who love the power, who love the status, who love the finance, who love to be the kings of their own kingdom. And Jesus is marching into Jerusalem and saying, you've got it all wrong. You're not to be the kings of your own kingdom. I have come to be the king. And he says the same thing to you and I this morning. Who's the king of your kingdom, or who's the king of your hearts? He wants complete lordship. But as you look at your heart this morning, and maybe like the fig tree, your heart is withering and you're dry from the roots. You've cut off Bible reading, prayer, meeting together to pray with others. And after weeks, months, and even years of allowing these things to kind of slip and to fade in your life, you feel spiritually withered like the fig tree. But there's hope this morning in this God-man, Jesus. There's hope this morning in the gospel, that the gospel isn't just for your salvation, but the gospel is this journey of sanctification from when God saved us to when he calls us home, that if we come this morning and confess our sin, he is faithful and just to forgive us and go on cleansing. So if you're like me and there's areas of my life which is a sense hypocritical, where I present myself as one thing yet I struggle with some other thing, there is grace and forgiveness for us who are hypocrites. Jesus is coming to offer forgiveness. He's coming to die on the cross for these sorts of people. But Jesus doesn't finish there. Look what he does in the second point. Jesus desires true worship. Verses 15 to 19. Jesus desires true worship. Jesus has made his way down through the Mount of Olives. And the Mount of Olives was kind of like the introductory phase to coming into the temple. And in the Mount of Olives, there would have been lots of areas that you could have bought things to go in and offer as a Passover sacrifice. But what happened was the chief priests and the scribes had become so corrupt that in the very introductory court, the court of the Gentiles, they had opened up all these markets so that they could earn money, so that they could extort those worshippers who were coming to bring their sacrifices to God. And so Jesus is full of rage and wrath. Just the night before he had come into the temple, he had seen all of the sinful practices that were going on. But look what happens in verse 15. When reaching Jerusalem, Jesus entered the temple area and began driving out those who were buying and selling there. He overturned the tables of the money changers and the benches of those selling doves. And it is a fulfillment of the prophecy that Jesus said in the Psalms, that zeal for your house will consume me. Jesus is enraged that people have turned the very house of God, where God should be worshipped, where he is set apart as holy, where his greatness is celebrated, that the chief priests and the scribes have become so hypocritical that they had turned the worship of God into the worship of themselves. At the start of Jesus' ministry in John chapter 2, verse 13 to 22, Jesus had already cleared the temple. when he went out in his ministry, he had gone in and had thrown out all the money changers and all the robbers that were in the temple because zeal for God's holiness consumed them. But just a few years later, the scribes and the Pharisees, because they love money, because they love prestige, because they love to be the kings of their kingdoms, slowly they had introduced the money changers and the scribes back into the temple. And sometimes that's a picture of sin in our lives, where we may uproot something, but it's just behavior modification. We must stop that, and we must not do this, and we have a rules and a regulations approach. But just a few days, hours, weeks, or months later, that sin has crept back into our lives because we still want to be king of our kingdom. We still want to love and please ourselves instead of God. And so the money changers and all the robbers are back in the temple, feeding the kingdom of the scribes and the Pharisees. But as Jesus comes to our hearts this morning, he asks you, whatever sin you're struggling with this morning, you can't just make behavior modification. You've got to make gospelized behavior modification. Well, you've got to apply the gospel to that particular sin issue that you're struggling with this morning. That you've got to let Jesus into your heart, Jesus into your temple, and let him begin to deal with it, as opposed to just cutting it off and thinking that's it done. Because Jesus wants true worshippers, not externally, but internally. He wants to transform our lives, and so he's coming into the temple to throw out the money changers. So Jesus enters the temple. There's massive scams going on. The first temple precinct that he would have entered was called the Court of the Gentiles. And it was meant to be a place of prayer for Gentiles. The Gentiles, of course, at that stage were not the people of God. In a sense, this was to be a place of evangelism where Gentiles could come into the kingdom, where they could pray, where they could be ministered to. But the chief priests and the scribes had turned it into a scam, extorting the poor who would have bought doves, which were very cheap animals, to offer as a sacrifice, which would have been 2 or 3p to buy in their local town. But when they got into the temple precincts, into the court of the Gentiles, it would have been £2 or £3. And then because they came from Gentile nations, they would have had a certain type of currency. And then to buy that dove, they would have had to change the currency. And then the chief priests and the scribes made money out of the transactions. This was a complete scam. They were building their own kingdom when it was meant to be a house of prayer to the Gentile nations. Jesus wants to protect the holiness of God. He wants true worshippers. I love what David said about the temple of God and how he just wanted to be a true worshipper. David said in Psalm 27 verse 4, "One thing I've asked of the Lord, that I will seek after, that I might dwell in the house of the Lord." And David would have been meditating about the temple. "That I will seek after, that I might dwell in the house of the Lord all the days of my life, to gaze upon the beauty of the Lord and to inquire in his temple." David was a true worshipper. Here he is saying, "I want God and I want God alone." And then the question comes to you and I, is that our desire? Or is it Jesus alone and power? Jesus alone and promotion. Jesus alone and that house. Jesus alone and that car. Jesus alone and the success of my kids. Whereas Jesus is crying out, "I want true worshippers who worship me in spirit and truth, where the kingdom of God and his greatness are the number one priority. And then all these other things will be added onto you." And so Jesus asks us for correct perspective. And not that those things, those good gifts that God gives us are wrong, but that they must come in kingdom perspective. And as God shines his light on our hearts and he puts the microscope into our hearts, what does he see this morning at the center of your life and your temple? Is it God's kingdom or is it your own kingdom? He wants complete control. He wanted complete control in the center of the temple life in the nation of Israel. And he wants complete control in your temple this morning. Look at his zeal to keep the holiness of God intact. Verse 16. He would not allow anyone to carry merchandise through the temple courts. And as he taught them, he said, "It is written, my house will be called a house of prayer for all nations, but you have made it a den of robbers." The chief priests and the teachers of the law heard this. Remember Jesus, the fig tree? The disciples heard it. Jesus has made sure, as he says these words, that the Pharisees and the scribes have heard this and began looking for a way to kill him. See the master planner? Up until this point, the chief priests and the scribes are going to try and kill Jesus and arrest him after this week of festivity, after the Passover week. But Jesus is planning every last moment leading to his death on the Friday. And the chief priests and the scribes hear what he's saying about the temple. He's now about to step on their hearts, to step on their kingdom. And the chief priests and the scribes saying, "If you're going to step on our hearts and our kingdom, we're going to sort you out, Jesus." And so the chief priests and the scribes look for a way to kill Jesus. But when the evening came, verse 19, they went out of the city. You can just imagine how Jesus must have felt. This was the temple of God. This was the place where the Holy of Holies was, where the very presence of God dwelt in the center of the people of God, the nation of Israel, and that humanity in their sin and their love of themselves and their own kingdom had turned it into a den of robbers. And I was trying to think what Jesus must have felt as he walked out of the temple and he saw all the sin. And then I thought about myself. And the Bible says, 1 Corinthians 3, that the temple of God is now within you. And I think about how Jesus must feel about my love of self and my love of sin. Yet he's looking for a whole heart. He's looking for a true worshipper who will not just acknowledge him with his lips, but that his heart will be engaged in worship. But Jesus isn't finished there. He wants to teach his disciples another lesson, as he's only got 2 or 3 days left before he dies on the cross. And so he gives us a third point from verse 20 to 25. Jesus commands faithful prayer. Jesus commands faithful prayer. Verse 20, in the morning, as they went along, they saw the fig tree withered from the roots. You see how important it was for the disciples to have heard and seen what Jesus said just a day before about the fig tree. Now the disciples are on this same road back between Bethany, Bethphage, and the Jerusalem temple, and they're going back and forth, and now they're going back towards the temple this day, and they see the fig tree. And they see that it's withered from the roots. That means total destruction for the fig tree. It will never be able to live again. This was to fulfill another word of prophecy. In Hosea chapter 9, verse 15. Hosea 9, verse 15 says, "Because of their sinful deeds, I will drive them out of my house. I will no longer love them. All their leaders are rebellious. Ephraim is blighted. Their root is withered. They yield no fruit, even if they bear children. I will slay their cherished offspring." Here's the fulfillment of prophecy. In Jesus' journey to the cross on the Friday, he has now rejected the temple and its precincts. The Jewish people thought that Jesus would come in and reform the temple, that he would restore it again. But what Jesus came in and he did, he actually shattered the temple system. Because on Good Friday, what happened was Jesus was going to die on the cross. And what happened then back in this temple, in the very Holy of Holies, the very top of the center of the temple, it says that the curtain was torn apart from top to bottom. So what Jesus was actually doing for you and for me during this week that we're reading about is that he was coming to institute a new and a living way. That when he died on the cross and he cried out to his Father, my God, why have you forsaken me?" And then the temple curtain split from top to bottom. It was so that you and I could enter into an amazing relationship with God. Now the way has been made open. There would no longer need to be the court of the Gentiles, the court of the nations, the court of Israel, the Holy of Holies. What Jesus did when he offered up his life, he actually made the way open so that the temple of God could now be within. But Peter and the disciples, if you and I were there as well, we wouldn't have grasped all that. And Peter was trying to understand this verse 21. Peter remembered and said to Jesus, "Rabbi, look, the fig tree you cursed has withered." Jesus was on the journey to institute this new temple. In his own body, the temple is being broken down, and in himself, he will make a ransom for many. It will be raised again in 3 days, but this time it will be a temple made without hands. Not the blood of animals slaughtered by the high priest on the Day of Atonement, but his own blood, the blood of the new covenant, which will make the people right before God. You see, this morning, Jesus alone is our access to God. And now, instead of having to go and offer sacrifices, we have to dwell in words like John chapter 15, verse 4. This new and living way is illustrated by John about how we should live with God and Jesus Christ in the center of our hearts. John chapter 15, verse 4. "Abide in me and I in you. As the branch cannot bear fruit by itself unless it abides in the vine, neither can you unless you abide in me. I am the vine and you are the branches. Whoever abides in me and I in him, he is that bears much fruit. For apart from me, you can do nothing." Jesus has instituted a new and living way. Where the follower of Christ in Bangor in February 2012 no longer has to go into the Holy of Holies, but the Holy of Holies through Christ is now within them. And he asks us to cultivate holiness and righteousness in our hearts in the new temple. But why is Jesus talking about prayer here? Why is he commanding faithful prayer? Well, for 3 years, the disciples have walked and talked with Jesus along the roads, sleeping together in courtyards outside, eating together, sharing many meals, seeing amazing things done. If there was a storm at sea and they had a problem in their lives, Jesus would calm the storm. If they didn't have any food, Jesus would say, "Go to that young boy and bring his bread and his fish and I'll turn it in and feed everyone here." If they didn't know what direction they were going in, Jesus would put them in the right direction. But Jesus knows in just a few days' time, he's going to die on the cross. And then days after that, he's going to reappear. And then after that, he's going to be with his Father. And he knows that the disciples will no longer have access to him. And so their faith was going to have to be in a God that they cannot see. Jesus here talks about moving mountains, and I think the moving mountains was symbolic of the problems and the perplexities that the disciples were going to have to come up against in the future. And you and I as disciples in our culture in 2012, and we think about the mountains within our lives, the struggles that we have. How are we going to cope? How are we going to do this with a God that we cannot see? Verse 22, Jesus says to the disciples, "Have faith in God." And there's a great debate, which would take us hours to sort out, about whether this is a promise from Jesus in verse 23 to 25, and I'll read it to you. "I tell you the truth, if anyone says to this mountain," could have been the Temple Mount, could have been the Mount of Olives, could have been a metaphorical mountain. "I tell you the truth, if anyone says to this mountain, 'Go throw yourself into the sea,' and does not doubt in his heart, but believes that what he says will happen, it will be done for him. Therefore, I tell you, whatever you ask in prayer, believe that you have received it and it will be yours. And when you stand praying, if you hold anything against anyone, forgive him, so that your Father in heaven may forgive your sins." There's great debate all about what these passages mean, but I believe we need to keep to the truth of verse 22. Jesus was saying to his disciples, you're going to come up against all kinds of problems within your life, mountains that seem immovable, that you won't be able to do anything. But think what happened after Jesus left. This was an important lesson that he taught them. The disciples are discouraged where Jesus has gone. He's ascended back to his Father. They're gathered there in that upper room in Pentecost. And what do they do when faced with the problems around them? They get together to pray. And suddenly tongues of fire rush upon them. And suddenly they go out to speak in miraculous languages to people of every tribe, tongue and nation. And 3,000 are added that day. And they would do many miracles, signs and wonders. Many mountains would be moved. Why? Because they were to have faith. Not in themselves. Not in their own kingdom. Not in their own strength. But in God.